This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
A new strain of the coronavirus in the UK, it's created additional restrictions and plenty of angry truck drivers.
The whole situation is ridiculous. I mean, in all honesty, truck drivers don't come in contact with people.
Also today, Russian hackers and a major attack on American agencies. In Spycraft, this is business as usual.
I don't think that we can have a norm saying espionage is okay, but when it's too successful, it's not okay.
I'm Marco Werman. The Pacific island nation of Fiji was hit with back-to-back cyclones this year. Leaders are certain climate change is to blame.
This is a no-brainer to me for two of the worst storms that just can't be normal, that absolutely can't be normal.
And Indonesia marketing its new Jurassic Park.
It's safe for the people, but it's not safe for the animals.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you with us this Monday. Troubling news from parts of Britain. A new variant of the coronavirus is spreading rapidly. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, when the virus changes its method of attack, we must change our method of defense. So Christmas has effectively been cancelled for millions of people there, and the rest of Europe doesn't want Brits coming in. It's creating chaos for British travelers. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us from London. Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, was just speaking on national television, Orla. What did he have to say?
He focused mainly, in fact, on what's been happening at the port of Dover in Britain today, which is where hundreds of lorries have been parked up because of the French ban on arrivals from the UK. So truck drivers heading from Dover over to Calais, they have been stopped and will be stopped for the next 48 hours. And there was absolute chaos there this morning. So he focused on that mainly, but he also sent out a message to his international colleagues.
To our international friends and partners, I want to say very frankly that we understand your concerns. And I hope everybody can see that as soon as we were briefed in UK government on the fast transmissibility of this new strain, we lodged all the necessary information with the World Health Organization, and we took prompt and decisive action the very next day.
Right now, more than three dozen countries have banned flights or ferries leaving for Britain. The Channel is closed. What is the situation at UK airports and seaports right now?
Yes, and it's not only the seaports and the airports, Marco, it's also the train stations, because the train stations were complete bedlam over the weekend, particularly on Saturday. At the airports, what has been happening is that as each of the countries has announced their ban of 48 hours, or in some cases like Bulgaria, it's until the end of January, the airlines have been slow at reacting. So many of the passengers have turned up at the airports and only discovered then that their flights were cancelled. You had the situation in Germany this morning, the people arrived into the airports in Germany and in fact were then held at the airport and not allowed to leave because Germany had introduced a ban. At the ports today, as you say, it has been pretty chaotic. There was around 500 trucks and lorries stuck there this morning. What they've had to do is create this huge lorry park just outside the port of Dover so that truck drivers essentially can sit there for 48 hours and just sleep and eat and whatever in their trucks. But a truck driver, Rick Mayo, who was stuck at the port of Dover, was talking to the BBC earlier and is clearly frustrated.
But the whole situation is ridiculous because when the pandemic first started, trucks were running freely. I mean, in all honesty, truck drivers don't come in contact with people. We are in the truck on our own. We self-isolate for 3 to 4 days at a time. I mean, when I leave home, I don't see anybody or talk to anybody for the first 3.5 days.
Are a lot of people affected where you are? I mean, what kinds of stories are you hearing in your London neighbourhood?
Yeah, I think most people I know have been affected by this. For those of us who are due to fly home for Christmas with their families, it does mean that we'll be spending Christmas alone. I mean, I know one person who jumped in a car on a Saturday evening after the announcement, hired a car and drove straight to Scotland, that 8-hour trip on a rainy Saturday evening to Scotland. Another chap went to the ferry port last night to catch a ferry to France at 11 p.m. and was allowed board the ferry. But then the announcement came through of the French ban, and they realised that the ferry wasn't going to arrive into France till 3 a.m. French time, so that was after midnight, so the ferry was cancelled. And usually for people in big cities, when that happens, you can kind of gather together and get a group of you together, but because that's not allowed this year, essentially most people are saying, let's just cancel Christmas.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Orla, thanks for checking in. Good luck.
Cheers. Thanks, Marco.
So much is changing in the UK, and quickly, because of this new mutation. But virus mutations in and of themselves are not necessarily a big deal. The World's Ilana Gordon has been looking into the science of what exactly is going on right now. So Ilana, help us understand, is a mutation a red flag?
So all viruses have mutations. They mutate. That in itself is completely normal. One scientist, Marco, described it to me as almost like clockwork. Emma Hodcroft is a molecular epidemiologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland, and she laid it out plain and simple for me. When viruses replicate in our bodies and copy themselves, there's a chance they make a typo.
Most mutations don't change how the virus works at all. They're just little mistakes.
So think of it like an identifiable scratch on a car. Are you with me?
I got it. It's totally normal. No big deal. Predictable. But what about these mutations, the ones that scientists and leaders seem to be sounding the alarm about in the UK?
Right. So in the UK, scientists have identified a collection of these mutations, something called a variant. And most variants don't change how viruses actually work, but they're always on the lookout to see if a variant might give the virus an edge and change its behavior. Bill Hanich is an epidemiologist at Harvard, and he tells me that this new variant has caught scientists' attention because of how quickly it went from being really rare to being associated with a large rise in cases in the UK.
You look at it, you kind of go, oh, that's interesting. But the fact that it has been so rapidly increasing is the cause for concern.
And so the tricky part is figuring out if and how exactly a variant may be causing changes in the virus's behavior, or whether it's human behavior that's causing it to spread more.
Where else are scientists seeing this particular variant globally?
So samples have also been found in Denmark and Australia, and that's not too surprising given travel. There's also a variant in South Africa that's gotten a lot of attention too. And the thing with this, Marco, is that it is different from the UK variant. But they share a similarity. The one in South Africa has a particular mutation that is in common with the UK one, and that mutation has been associated with rising cases in South Africa, too. And so scientists are wondering about what clues that might reveal about if there's something more to this mutation and variant.
Presumably they'll find out, we hope, but what we know is that mutations are happening. Before this variant hit the news, Ilana, we were talking about the vaccine and how it's being rolled out. What is this going to mean for the vaccine?
So the short answer is that scientists like Emma Hodcroft in Switzerland say it would likely take a while for any one variant to evolve to outsmart a vaccine for COVID. Because these vaccines, they're all focused on teaching our bodies how to recognize a whole lot about this virus.
So a great analogy here is kind of like showing your body a mugshot of a bad guy. Even if the bad guy puts on sunglasses and a hat, you'd hopefully still recognize him.
So the issue then is whether a virus can develop a savvy enough disguise to hide from a vaccine or treatments and from our immune responses. And Hodcroft thinks that will take a while for it, but scientists are paying attention.
So Ilana, if it's possible that this variant spreads more easily, is there anything we should be doing differently behavior-wise?
Scientists all tell me the same thing, that the bottom line is the same as before. And that is that it's all the more important for people to just continue the basics, the masking, observing social distancing, and hand washing. Here's Harvard's Bill Hanich again.
You should remember that we have a bunch of things that we can do to reduce the risk of transmission, and we should keep doing them and maybe do them a little bit more. And as we understand more about it, we'll be able to better guide the public.
So it's all about staying vigilant as scientists navigate this gray area.
The World's Ilana Gordon. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Let's get back to a story we've been following, the massive cyber attack on the U.S. federal government. There's still a lot we don't know about just how Russian hackers did it. What we do know, at least six government departments were breached in what's being called the worst cyber attack ever on the U.S. We also know that a few corporations got caught up in the operation that likely began back in March. To get the latest, we reach out to Dmitry Alperovich. He's a co-founder of CrowdStrike, a cybersecurity firm that helped find the Russians in the Democratic National Committee systems 4 years ago. He also heads a think tank called the Silverado Policy Accelerator. Dmitry, what are we learning now about the nature and extent of this digital espionage operation? How widespread is it?
It is probably the biggest cyber espionage campaign against our country in our history. However, it is important not to overhype it even further because it is an espionage campaign. That's what it looks like right now. It's certainly possible that we'll learn more in the future. But for now, no destruction has taken place. There's been no leaking of the data that's been stolen. And the agency that is believed to have been responsible for this, SVR, which is a Russian civilian intelligence agency, somewhat equivalent to our CIA, has traditionally engaged in traditional espionage, not in destructive acts, unlike other agencies within the Russian government. So it's bad. It has a huge impact on our national security, but it's not war. It's not digital Pearl Harbor. And those analogies, I don't think, are helpful.
Yeah, so Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, called the hack virtually a declaration of war by Russia on the United States. What do you make of a characterization like that?
I just don't think it's helpful. I think the type of attack that was done here is incredibly impressive. It is the type of operation that you would hope our own intelligence services are engaging in against our adversaries on a daily basis to get as much information as possible from their networks. But nothing destructive took place here. Espionage, of course, is one of the oldest professions in the world. Every country engages in it. And I don't think that we can have a norm saying espionage is okay, but when it's too successful, it's not okay. The fact of the matter is, it was spectacularly successful. They got to so many victims, both within government and private sector, but they stole data. They didn't destroy it. And I think that distinction is important.
So, Dmitry, talk a bit about U.S. defensive capabilities against hacks, because the NSA, some have said, is the front window of a kind of a glass house. What can the U.S. do right now?
The U.S. intelligence community has phenomenal offensive capabilities. I think the best in the world. So it would not at all be surprising if similar types of operations like the ones that we're seeing here is being conducted as we speak by our own intelligence community against our adversaries, which is why I think the analogies to war are so unhelpful and could be potentially hypocritical. But the reality is that on defense, we're not in good shape. And we need to do much better. And first and foremost, we need to really reorganize our government for success. And the fact of the matter is, we now have an agency in CISA, the cybersecurity agency that's part of DHS, that ostensibly has a mission to do cybersecurity, but until recently had no authorities to actually do so. And the recently passed NDAA bill, the Defense Authorization Act, which is now on its way to the president's desk, although he's threatening to veto it, has critical provisions in there to actually give CISA the mission to defend federal government networks.
Do any of these revelations support some of what Edward Snowden revealed about how things work at the NSA in 2013?
Well, I think that those revelations show that every country out there with advanced capabilities, whether it's US or Russia or China, is essentially blanketing the world in massive espionage campaigns to further their own national interests. And in the case of China in particular, also to help their domestic sector through economic espionage. But this is happening by everyone, and people that thought that it was outrageous that NSA was doing a bunch of spying need to appreciate now that our adversaries are doing the exact same thing to us.
So, final question, Dmitry. I mean, how would you differentiate between a hack and actual espionage?
Well, all of these are hacks, but I would differentiate espionage from an attack, where an attack involves destructive operations, shutting down of computers, destroying data, holding data at ransom, or even leaking that data out publicly, as we saw during 2016. But an espionage campaign is simply theft of that information by an intelligence agency, where they'll use it to undermine our national security, of course, or provide information to their policymakers in Moscow. And again, something that should be very, very concerning to everyone listening right now, but not an act of war. Espionage has been taking place against our country for many decades, and it will continue to do so, and we just need to get better at stopping it.
Dmitry Alperovich, the co-founder of CrowdStrike. He also heads the Silverado Policy Accelerator think tank. Really appreciate your time, Dmitry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fiji is a nation of low-lying islands, so it's bad news when massive storms roll through. We speak with Fiji's ambassador to the UN about last week's cyclone and what it tells us about climate change. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Fiji has been hit by two tropical cyclones this year. Yasa ripped into Fiji late last week. Nearly the whole island nation was braced for impact. More than 95% of Fiji's people live in the direct path of the storm. Their ambassador to the United Nations, Satyendra Prasad, is with me now. Mr. Ambassador, what news have you been getting from back home? How bad has the damage been?
This has been a devastating cyclone. We have possibly in the range of 2,000 houses that have been fully blown away. Infrastructure, roads, jetties, power, water, all of the crucial infrastructure is damaged and will take many, many months to bring back online. One of the islands does not have a single house that is left standing. The only infrastructure that is left standing is the village church. And that's about 200 households, and they do not have access to water. And that's the story across many, many of the small islands.
Mm. How bad is the COVID situation in Fiji, and how has the pandemic impacted recovery efforts?
So Fiji is what we say a COVID-contained country, but the price that Fiji has paid for this lockdown has been in its tourist industry. The economic impacts of that severe and substantial. Fiji has rarely dealt, it's only once in its history dealt with a cyclone with this ferocity, with this intensity. And second, it is responding to one at a time when its own resources are just so thin on the ground.
Yeah? Yeah, so it's a worrying kind of double hit. Do you draw a direct connection, Mr. Ambassador, between these storms and climate change? Have you noticed more frequent or destructive storms in your lifetime?
This is a no-brainer to me. For two of the worst storms to have hit the whole of the Southern Hemisphere in the last 5 years alone, that just can't be normal. That absolutely can't be normal. Never in our history, as compared to the last 10 years or so, have you seen the short space of time in which cyclones form, intensify, and super intensify and become destructive. And this surely has to do with rising sea temperatures, absolutely, without doubt. And all the scientists are with us in this assessment.
Despite the fact that Fiji is a low-lying island nation and sea level rise threatens its entire existence, your Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, posted this very determined and resolute statement on Facebook with the cyclone winds starting to bear down on Fiji.
Due to climate change, these storms may be getting stronger, but they will never be stronger than we are. Resilience is in our bones. We will recover. We will rebuild. We will prove ourselves stronger than Yasa.
Mr. Ambassador, where does your Prime Minister get that confidence if it's other richer countries that are the source of climate change emissions? And what do you think it'll take for Fiji to survive the impacts of climate change?
Fijians are very resilient. They will fight back. And I know fully well that we'll come out stronger from this. We have a great sense of community, a deeply religious people. And at times like this, the whole community rises up naturally and lends a helping hand wherever and in whichever way we can do. The entire government machinery has already been mobilized well in advance of the cyclone. The whole of the government is fully engaged. The confidence comes from that, where we fall short. It's the solidarity that we need at moments like this. We need long-term and very solid partnerships with countries who can help us.
Fiji's ambassador to the United Nations, Satyendra Prasad, thank you very much for giving us this update.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Wonderful talking to you.
He's one of the biggest recording artists in Latin America, with 14 Latin Grammys under his belt, including three more this year. Colombian artist Carlos Vives has been singing for more than 30 years. As The World's Jorge Valencia reports, his new album is all about love.
Eres tan linda que voy a perder.
Carlos Vives' nominations in the Latin Grammys this year included Best Song. It's called For Sale. Yeah, the knees in English. And this bop is nostalgic. He sings that he's never going to forget your love. And he could be singing about you, or he could also be singing about his identity and his native Colombia.
A la identidad es tratar de que todo lo que mis expresiones tengan que ver mucho con lo que soy.
He says he's always wanted his work to be a reflection of where he's from. Carlos Vives has sold more than 200 million copies worldwide of his 15 studio albums. And his relationship with Colombia's biodiversity and Afro-Colombian and indigenous music are the heart of his new record. It's called Cumbiana. He says that's why, even though he constantly travels the Spanish-speaking world, he always returns to Bogotá.
Bogotá para mí.
For me, Vives says, Bogotá is the capital of music. He says that's where he built his career over the last three decades. His international breakthrough was a cover of the 1938 traditional Colombian song La Gota Fría by singer Emiliano Zuleta. Vives' cover was polished and upbeat. Vives has often borrowed from Afro-Colombian musicians like Alejandro Duran. But even though Black and indigenous musicians have made an outsized contribution to Colombian pop music, it's mostly white mestizo artists like Vives who have reaped the benefit.
Sí, sí, no, no, esos son, ya, es decir, son las mañas que quedan de, pues, de una industria un poquito acomplejada.
He says it's the legacy of a music industry that has an inferiority complex. In a documentary and a book Vives wrote to accompany his new record, he talks about the communities who created the unique style of Colombian cumbia.
No podemos ser injustos con esa sangre que corre en nuestro pueblo. Que tiene que ver con la sangre chipcha.
Vives says he doesn't want Colombia to be unfair to indigenous groups like the Chipcha language speakers or the Kogi and Chimila peoples. He also speaks of an environmental crime happening in the delta where Colombia's largest river, the Magdalena, meets the Caribbean Sea. Sandra Vilardi is an ecologist who worked on Vives' documentary.
Sin duda, o sea, esto fue, ha sido uno de los errores de infraestructura vial del país más grande que se.
Vilardi says two roads built along the Magdalena River some 60 years ago interrupted the flow between the river and the Caribbean. The result has been the decimation of vast mangroves and wetlands and a loss of livelihood for tens of thousands of people, many of them indigenous, who directly depend on the health of the Magdalena Delta.
Todavía no se logra dimensionar la magnitud.
The Colombian government still does not recognize the magnitude of the problem, Vilardi says. So the singer Carlos Vives says he wants to use his international fame to talk about environmental issues such as this one.
Ya yo entiendo y lo uso para estos mensajes, para que hablemos de esta ciénaga.
Vives says he hopes the government will raise one of the roads along the Magdalena to allow for the salt and fresh waters of the delta to mix again. Vives says he's committed to the Magdalena and the Caribbean because it's the region that has given him and so many others their music. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
We'll be right back. You're with the world. A knock on the door, a possible raid. Undocumented immigrants live in a world of anxiety.
When I was 5, 6 years old, I walked around with my birth certificate because raids always happen and pickups. But this is different.
The pandemic and uncertain policies demand attention for mental health support. Therapists are banding together to help. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. The plan, the poisoning, the cover-up, and now the case cracked wide open. This is not an Agatha Christie whodunit. This is real life. The poisoning of Alexei Navalny, the Russian opposition leader who was targeted this summer. A joint news investigation is now shedding light on many of the missing details about this attack. Roman Dobrokhotov in Moscow has those details. He's the editor-in-chief of the Russian news publication, The Insider. Roman, you and I spoke last week about the investigation into this poisoning of Navalny that you, along with Bellingcat, CNN, and others were part of. What new details have we learned as of today?
Well, actually, when we were speaking last week, I already knew these new details because we made this telephone calls that we are using for a second part of our investigation. We made these telephone calls right before publishing because we wanted to call all the FSB officers that we found, officers that followed Navalny and participated in these poisoning attacks, to take a command from them. And we understood that, of course, no one will admit that they participated in the operation. So we decided to make it a little bit more interesting, and we asked Alexei Navalny to call at least some of them. In the last minute, Alexei Navalny decided that he will pretend that he is helper of head of our security council, Nikolai Patrushev. And he started telling what was going on. And he told everything. He told everything about his colleagues. He told where they put poison. He told why they failed to kill Navalny, etc., etc.
So just run through it with me, Roman. What did this agent from the FSB, Konstantin Kudryavtsev, what did he tell Navalny on the phone?
So the most important parts are that we know how they use the poison. So they put it in the inner side of his pants, how we call it?
Underwear.
Like underwear, yeah, because they needed it to be on his body. So we know this because this person, Kudryavtsev, he was responsible for cleaning this poison from his clothes. So he mentioned the exact part that he was supposed to clean.
So Kudryavtsev asserted to Navalny on the phone that if the pilot had not landed the plane to attend to a sick Alexei Navalny, the operation would have succeeded. Didn't the agent also tell Navalny that he was sent after the fact to get rid of evidence?
Yeah, we knew it from the very beginning that Kudryavtsev went to Omsk, where Navalny was in the hospital, already after Navalny left for Germany to get rid of the evidence. So he was used as a person to make the cleanup.
Roman, the reputation Russian intelligence generally has is they're smart, they're skeptical, they're kind of wily. How did Navalny get this FSB agent to talk?
Well, first of all, FSB is a very, very big organization. There are thousands and thousands of people with very different level of intelligence. Some of them are very clever and experienced people, very cautious. And some of them are very dumb people who believe in absolutely BS conspiracy theories that even small children wouldn't believe in. So we don't know about these concrete people, what is their level of experience and education, but I think that still they are very well trained in comparison with most of FSB officers, because most of them are just making paperwork or working in the regions. But these people, two of them are doctors, two of them are experts on chemical weapons, one of them is trained in special force unit. I also would expect some professionals from them. But you know, when you have a group of eight people, usually at least one of them would make a very silly mistake, especially in a very, very stressful situation, because this is extremely stressful situation. I bet this is the biggest operation that they ever had, and they failed it. And now they think that Putin's main chef of intelligence, Patrushev, needs some report. So, of course, in this very stressful situation, I think they can easily make some stupid mistake, like speaking on an open line. And we saw things like this happening before.
Well, right now, Navalny is still recovering in Germany, but he said many times that he plans to return to Russia as soon as he's better. Now he's got proof of what happened to him at the hands, it seems, of the Russian government. So how do you think Russian people will respond when he returns?
Well, the epidemiological situation is very bad in Russia, especially when winter started. And of course, not a lot of people want to risk to gather in big crowds. So I think that people, they are now feeling more and more aggressive against all this Putin's activities. And I'm pretty sure that we will see very big protests next year, but not right now.
Roman Dobrokhotov, editor-in-chief of The Insider, speaking with us from Moscow. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
10 years ago, many of us would have been hard-pressed to say what Xinjiang is. But after mounting evidence of strict Chinese surveillance and more than a million Uyghurs held in internment camps, the autonomous region in northwest China has gotten more international attention. Reports also show that many Uyghurs are forced to pick cotton in Xinjiang and work in factories that supply international brands. Beijing has repeatedly denied those allegations, but as the world's Rupert Shenoy reports, the Uyghurs may see a breakthrough in their long struggle in 2021.
Activists on social networks have done more to raise awareness about what's happening to Uyghurs, a Muslim minority in China, than all the international leaders put together. That was the assessment of European Parliament member Raphael Glucksmann of France during an official debate last Thursday. Here he's being translated by an EU interpreter.
J'accuse.
I'm accusing the Chinese authorities of the worst crime of the 21st century. I am also accusing the international community for being a part of this crime, for abetting it through its silence. And I also am accusing Nike and other multinational corporations that are taking advantage of slavery.
Nike and other companies say they've done what they can to make sure they're not using slave labor. But the European Parliament went on to adopt a resolution that condemns the Chinese government for the forced labor and exploitation of Uyghurs. It calls for sanctions on Chinese officials responsible for abuses against Uyghurs and a ban on imports made with forced labor. Uyghur American Salih Hudayr leads the nonprofit East Turkestan National Awakening Movement. East Turkestan was the name of the Uyghur Republic before China took control.
It is progress, but we would have hoped that they would have recognized it as a genocide, but hopefully we can get that recognition in the near future as well.
They charge genocide because there's evidence that Uyghurs are being tortured and killed. In July, Hudayr's group and other Uyghurs submitted a complaint to the International Criminal Court accusing China of interning a million Uyghurs. In a major development last week, ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda addressed their complaint in an annual report. She said there was, quote, no basis to proceed because the alleged acts happened in China, and China isn't a signatory to the treaty that established the ICC. So the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction.
Many people and much of the media has reported that, you know, the ICC has rejected the Uyghurs ICC complaint. However, that's not necessarily true.
Hudayr says the complaint is still active. He and others just need to present evidence that China has also unlawfully arrested and detained Uyghurs in Tajikistan and Cambodia, surrounding countries that do belong to the ICC. They're obtaining that evidence with the help of a powerful new group called the Interparliamentary Alliance on China, or IPAC. Luke Dippleford is acting as its coordinator. He's director of the Arise Foundation, an anti-slavery NGO.
I was actually quite hopeful when I saw the judgment because I thought, okay, right. Well, if you're wanting more evidence of very severe crimes that have happened to Uyghurs outside of China, then great. Well, we've got that. Let's work on that. Pull that together.
Dippleford says IPAC is made up of roughly 150 prominent lawmakers from 19 countries. That includes Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio in the U.S. The group came together to work on human rights issues, in part out of frustration about a lack of action at the United Nations. Dippleford says IPAC was one of the forces behind another recent development. In early December, Britain's House of Lords voted for legislation that would require a human rights impact assessment for any trade deal. For the first time, it would give UK judges the power to declare whether there's evidence of genocide in another country and to revoke a trade agreement if there is.
There had never been an urgent question in the UK Parliament on Uyghurs before IPAC. It's got Parliament talking about it much more than ever before. And I think that we're partly responsible for that, no doubt about it.
Dippleford says international efforts finally seem to be snowballing. In October, Canada came close to officially declaring the Uyghur crisis a genocide with a report from a parliamentary committee studying the issue. This was Liberal Canadian Parliament member Peter Fonseca from Ontario.
The subcommittee unequivocally condemned the persecution of this population and was persuaded to state that these actions constitute genocide.
All this may bode well for legislation in the U.S. Senate that would ban imports made in Xinjiang unless companies can prove that their products were not made with forced labor. After all, this summer, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Chinese officials responsible for the persecution of Uyghurs. Some say that started the momentum on Uyghur issues that's intensifying now. Sally Hudayer of the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement says more positive steps can't come soon enough.
Inside East Turkestan, the people there are facing unforeseen atrocities since the Holocaust. Every day that we are silent, more and more people are being killed.
Including four of his family members within the last 2 years, Hudayer says. He hopes he still has some family left when the international community finally takes meaningful action. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The fear of deportations or family separation has long taken an emotional toll on many immigrants in the U.S. and also on people who work with them, professionals like therapist Lou Rocha.
I have undocumented folks who are pregnant. In the event that you're going to be deported, who can you leave your child with? This is the reality for my people.
Now mix in a pandemic and uncertainty about where immigration policies are heading. The trauma has only become more acute. Reporter Valeria Fernandez has our story.
My name is Lou Rocha. I am from Chicago. I am a trauma therapist.
Like many therapists, Lou Rocha uses breathing techniques, meditation, and yoga. But she also asks her clients,
what stories have you heard about within your own family, your own community? What did they do for healing?
Rocha works with communities of color and immigrants. Some tell her that they pray with a rosary. Others, from parts of Latin America, say their grandmother used to rub an egg on their body to ease headaches. They believe the egg absorbs negative energy. Rocha gets it. Her parents are from Mexico. She also gets what many of her clients have faced, years of the Trump administration's tough immigration policies.
When I was 5, 6 years old, I walked around with my birth certificate because raids always happen and pickups from the immigration always happen, which is now ICE. But this is different. This time, these past 4 years, is trauma just about every week. And my people are tired. My people are sick. My people are dying.
Rocha is part of the Latinx Therapist Action Network, which now has a presence in 20 states. To take part, therapists must be committed to supporting immigrant communities and the movements allied with them. There's also a recognition that therapy can be too expensive for uninsured undocumented immigrants, so people pay what they can. Francisca Porchas created the Therapist Network. We met on her patio in Phoenix, where she lives with her family and a few roosters. I know Porchas because of her immigrant rights activism, which exposed her to a lot of trauma. She realized that suffering affected activists too.
I'm an organizer. I know how to bring people together. And so I want to bring healers, therapists, different types of folks together to really support and bring the kind of resources to the community that's needed.
Over 2 years, Porchas got 84 therapists to join the network. It took time to find therapists who are in some cases immigrants themselves and might understand firsthand what it means to, say, face deportation. Without that understanding, there is a risk that someone who needs help might give up. That almost happened to Rey Wences, a human rights organizer in Chicago. They say they didn't feel understood by other therapists.
I had to do a lot of background explaining context of immigration law, spending the time talking about immigration policy and just like demystifying some of the misconceptions that this therapist had made the distance between us grow.
Wences heard about the Latinx Therapist Action Network through Porchas and found a therapist who they've stuck with. The network is also working to expand its reach. Therapist Brenda Gandara recently held a Facebook Live hoping to connect with Spanish speakers.
Muchas veces me preguntan, ¿la ansiedad es normal? Y yo les pregunto a ustedes,
¿Qué creen ustedes?
Many times people ask if anxiety is normal, Gandara said during the event. In the comment section, someone wrote that they were suffering from anxiety. Another asked how to help a teenager.
Así que eso es todo lo que tengo. Espero que...
Over 500 people have watched the Facebook session. This summer, the therapist got a request from Siembra, an immigrant rights group in North Carolina, that said his community was overwhelmed with grief fueled by the pandemic, job losses, evictions, and anxiety about immigration enforcement. Sandra, who had to quit her restaurant job to care for her children, now at home for school, connected with the network. She asked to use her first name only because she's undocumented.
Si voy a la tienda y nos para la policía y me deportan y yo sin trabajar y tantas cosas.
Along with financial stress, she said she felt afraid of going to the store, getting pulled over by the police, and facing possible deportation. She got depressed and felt anger toward her four children. Sandra also lives in a rural area and couldn't find a Spanish-speaking therapist who understood her culture and circumstances. Through the Latinx network, she attended a workshop and learned breathing techniques. A therapist also described her anxiety in ways no one had before, with words she understood. She was also reminded of other ways she could heal, like connecting with her ancestors. Sandra liked that suggestion. Now, every few weeks, she pours herself a cup of tea and talks to her deceased grandmother and mom as if they were at the table with her. Sometimes she has long conversations with them. They still exist in her mind. They never leave her, she says. That's where she finds respite, connection, and peace. For The World, I'm Valeria Fernandez in Phoenix, Arizona.
Valeria reported the story with the support of the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. The Komodo dragon most definitely lives up to its name. The beast is nearly 200 pounds of lizard, 9 feet long, with teeth like a shark. No surprise, it is a predator and lives on remote islands in Indonesia. Now the government there wants to cash in on the Komodo dragon's reputation by bringing in more tourists for an entertainment experience inspired by Jurassic Park. A good idea? The World's Patrick Nguyen has our story.
That is a Komodo dragon, and the hiss means, back off, I will bite you. But better to be warned than ambushed. When hungry, these lizards lurk in the bushes, wait for prey to walk by, and then it's all gnashing teeth and snapping bones. A Komodo dragon devouring a deer in six big chomps. With humans, it's more likely to just bite and run away, if it attacks at all. But still, even one bite is really bad. Take it from Aloysius Suhartim Karya, a former ranger in Komodo National Park. He goes by Louis, and this is how he describes the animal's pointy teeth.
Like a needle. It goes straight into the, how do you call it? Yeah, the muscle, yeah?
Not just a needle, more like a syringe, injecting venom into the wound, which quickly spreads to your vital organs.
And then this will kill our heart, brains. It takes like 30 minutes.
30 minutes without treatment, and you're dead. And yet, tourists will pay good money to get close to these animals, for the thrill of it. There's fewer than 6,000 of these dragons, and they only live in one somewhat remote part of Indonesia. Now, Louis is no longer a ranger, he's a tour operator, an environmental activist. And this is how he describes the local tourism industry.
99.9%, it is due to Komodo dragon.
So, the local government, they've got a plan to build a deluxe park where intrepid tourists can fork out $1,000 to see these ancient lizards. The architects even put out a video, a mock-up of the park set to familiar music. Yep, that is the Jurassic Park theme song.
I don't really understand Indonesian government. Jurassic Park, it doesn't really make sense.
As Louis and others point out, it is a movie about humans meddling with nature and getting eaten by giant lizards. The park would cater to the wealthy, with sleek pavilions and terraces, looking down on a leafy island where the dragons crawl around. Is it dangerous? To humans, no, Louis says, but that's not the point.
It's safe for the people, but it's not safe for the animals. This will cause ecocide.
This will cause ecocide, he says, mowing down jungles where they live, where their prey live too, bringing in weird noises and smells that screw with their senses. Komodo dragons can smell things from 2 miles away. Louis says, look, the sort of tourists who come to Komodo don't want Jurassic Park. They want everything au naturel.
It is beautiful as it is. This will reduce the beauty of the island.
Yet just put this project aside for a second. Way too many people are already coming to these islands, like nearly 200,000 a year, all wanting to take selfies with dragons in the background. They go out with guides who are armed with sticks. They surround the Komodo dragons in the jungle and take videos for social media. Videos like this.
I'm getting film here.
Yeah.
Back up. Oh, got a battle.
Uh-oh.
I got the movie going too.
Tourists coming in and out day after day, and very few people get hurt, actually. But for the dragon, this is too much human contact. This animal is nearly endangered. This is why officials said, look, let's bring in fewer tourists, but spruce up the place, build a nicer park, and charge them $1,000 per person. I reached out to the park's director, Lukita Awang Nisiantara, to talk about this. He didn't respond, but he has released a video statement in Indonesian.
Dalam situasi wabah COVID pada saat ini, kami selaku pengelola tetap
saying the park is closed because of COVID-19, and quote, stay at home, we'll keep the dragons safe for you. So, sounds like the pandemic is giving the lizards a break, right? From tourists, yes, but construction is underway at the so-called Jurassic Park, and a photo recently leaked from the site. It's a Komodo dragon in a muddy construction pit, blocking the path of a big truck, bringing in steel to build the park. And the dragon is just staring it down.
The photo is telling us, Komodo dragon, no need human to protest.
Seems the lizards can protest on their own, Louis says. Some say it's like that protester in Tiananmen Square, blocking Chinese tanks.
They've seen that their house or their habitat is destroyed by the human, and they're getting angry.
And an angry Komodo dragon, generally speaking, is not what you want. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Sometimes amid all the upside-down smiles the news can bring, hearing about something hopeful, or even something reptilian, can be exactly what you need. Subscribe to The World's newsletter for a daily hit of global stories, plus a bright spot of good news so you can start your day informed and with a smile. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. A strange year for live music, but recorded music and music online, that has been a saving grace in 2020, from artists who continued entertaining us to amateur musicians who are enormously talented but didn't make a career out of it until we all started looking at everyone's chops during the pandemic. The World has featured a lot of this musical salvation in 2020. We built a playlist of some of the great music that kept our newsroom humming through the year. That's one of my selections on the playlist. New music from Ethiopian jazz legend Mulatu Astatke, a vibraphonist and organist. You can find the entire playlist at theworld.org. This number from Mulatu is from an album that came out this year titled To Know Without Knowing. It's a collaboration between Mulatu Astatke and the Melbourne, Australia band Black Jesus Experience. They're rooted in Ethiopian jazz, hip-hop, and funk, and have been collaborating with Mulatu for several years. To Know Without Knowing is their second album together. This is the track, Mulatu.
Respect to the Wurundjeri people, the Bunurong, the Yoruba Yoruba, where we station. Devout shout to the Kulin Nation, survivors of genocide and displacement in this modern day playpen. Too many fail to pay rent, not facing the urgency for decolonization. Music, the levitating force, of course, forth from the core, giving you more. BJX phenomenon, explore. Come on, feel the vibration. Keep the lightning enlightened. Keep it glowing till the night's igniting. Get it on with a room and a mic and a heavyweight sound. Let you know you did the right thing. Stick it waiting for the future, what it might bring. I'ma strike till the soul's in sight. In a ride with a megaphone, shout inviting. All of y'all to manifest this pipe dream. We on a...
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, online 24/7 at theworld.org. Again, that's also where you'll find our 2020 playlist. We'll be back with you right here tomorrow. Major, strong with the stamina, fierce like lion, laying it.